Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. At almost one-fifth of our gross domestic product, national healthcare spending reached another all-time high of $2.7 trillion in 2012. It's no wonder, then, that there's a steady drumbeat of pundits and policymakers who are actively looking at ways to achieve the contradictory goals of improving the quality of healthcare delivery while controlling costs. My guest today, former 33rd District State Senator Tom Adelson, is at the leading edge of these efforts. Appointed by former Governor Brad Henry as Oklahoma's first Secretary of Health in 2003, Adelson went on to serve two full terms in the Oklahoma legislature starting in 2004. After opting out of a run for re-election in 2012, Senator Adelson decided to go back to school. He's just completed the work for a master's degree in healthcare delivery science, a first-of-its-kind in the nation program offered at Dartmouth. Now back in the private sector, Adelson plans to put his new skills to use creating accountable care organizations and helping small hospitals avoid Medicare penalties. Senator Tom Adelson is my guest today here in studio at Studio Tulsa on Health. Senator Adelson, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Well, thanks for having me.
Glad you could be here. I want to start off by asking sort of a question that's probably on everybody's mind is, do you miss the legislature?
You know, I actually miss some of the personalities. I made some good friends. I don't think I'll miss being in the pit like that. I'm ready to move on back to the private sector, but I made some good relationships and I'll miss those folks.
When you talk about being in the pit of lawmaking, can you give me some examples of your time? I mean, you were in the Senate, I think, more than 8 years. What kinds of accomplishments were you able to achieve and what kinds were thwarted based on sort of the limited power of the Democratic caucus?
Well, when I started, we were in the majority. So I was actually an appropriations chairman for health and social services. And I was proud of the work we did. We enacted Insure Oklahoma, which is the current insurance program that allows people to purchase insurance with a premium, with a subsidy on the private market. We expanded coverage for kids through the Medicaid program. We spread mental health courts and drug courts almost statewide. And, you know, I thought that we made important investments that were to the benefit of the entire population. And then, of course, when the power transition occurred, you know, just the nature of the things, you don't really get to author as many bills, and you certainly don't have much of an input when it comes to appropriations. So you're more of a backbencher in some respects when you're in the minority of the party.
Trying to keep the other guys honest, as it were? Or
yeah, there's a little bit of that. We try to put pressure and use the bully pulpit, and sometimes you can.
Were you, the programs and appropriations you talked about in the first term, were those able to be sustained or maintained through, you know, up until present times?
Yeah, in fact, they all are. And a lot of times, I think the parties kind of enable one another to do things that we both think are right. So the health insurance expansion is still in place. They continue to expand mental health courts and drug courts. We have some premium assistance programs are still in place. And Insure Oklahoma is almost fully funded. We have about maybe 30, 32,000 Oklahomans who are benefiting from that.
For our audience, my understanding of it is that Governor Fallon has elected not to accept federal dollars for Medicaid expansion under Affordable Care. And I read where, I guess, her counter plan to accepting Medicaid dollars would be to maintain or expand Insure Oklahoma. Can you maybe make that simpler for us? I mean, is it an either-or choice?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think there's some question unresolved at this point if Insure Oklahoma will be recognized under the Affordable Care Act. In other words, can that program continue? I personally hope so. I think it's a good program. But to the extent that it may not be allowed to continue because the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, that's the federal partner, will not approve a continuing waiver of that program, you know, you're looking at a loss of maybe 30,000 folks who have insurance coverage and about $100 million in federal money that are coming into the state. So I'm, for one, worried about it. I'm sure she's probably got better information than I do at this point. Maybe she knows otherwise.
Now, you were, before you became senator, former Governor Brad Henry appointed you as Secretary of Health for Oklahoma. And if I read correctly, you were the first person to be in that position.
He did create that position. You know, healthcare, as you know, is such a compelling public policy challenge. He did create that position. Governor Fallon has it today. I think that folks on all sides of the aisle realize that it's probably good to have a subject matter expertise to advise the governor. And for the first 2 years of the governor's term, Governor Henry's term, it was a really great privilege and honor for me to serve that role.
And what were some of the issues that you tackled in that role back then?
Well, we had the tobacco tax that we enacted, parenthetically, with Lieutenant Governor Fallon's help at the time. It was great to have her support as well. And we were able to take that money and do some things on our trauma reimbursement system that is benefiting, you know, all the trauma centers today. And we started the first work on Insure Oklahoma. We found those state dollars from the tobacco tax, and then we got a waiver from the federal government to take Medicaid dollars, and instead of putting people in the Medicaid program, we basically fashioned or made a voucher for them to go purchase health insurance on the private market from a Blue Cross Blue Shield or an Aetna. And you know, I spent most of my time working on those two projects.
Now that the Affordable Care Act is the law of the land, and last summer's big Supreme Court decision where Chief Justice Roberts upheld at least the individual mandate, tell me your thoughts on, I guess, in a practical manner about implementing the Affordable Care Act. I mean, what are some of the challenges you see, and I guess what are the positive aspects of the law from where you sit?
Well, I guess those are two different questions. I mean, we have 40, 45 million uninsured Americans. We're the only industrialized country that hasn't figured this out. And the Affordable Care Act does extend coverage to those tens of millions of Americans. I think that's a terrific thing. And I really don't think there's an excuse for us not to have figured that out. So the coverage is going to really make a difference in the lives of millions of people. The Tulsa World, that would be January 28th, I think, had a big front page coverage on a clinic for low-income folks, I think in Shawnee. And it really captured the challenge that so many people face. They're able to get some preventive care for low cost or no cost. But a lot of things, you know, people can't get treated for. I think there was a story about a guy with a painful ingrown toe. There's dental coverage that people can't get. And there's really no excuse that we haven't figured this problem out. You know, Germany figured it out in 1897, England 20 or 30 years later, France, Belgium, all of Europe, Japan. So I think that to the extent the Affordable Care Act has addressed that problem, it's a good thing. In terms of challenges, it certainly is open to question and even doubt whether we're going to be able to bend the cost curve and whether we're going to be able to align patients with the best care that is available to them. And I think too often people get care that is not of the quality that they could otherwise get. And sometimes they're getting care that they shouldn't get because we have a problem of under-treatment for uninsured and maybe over-treatment for people who have really rich insurance coverage. So there's an issue with transparency and information asymmetries and access to quality providers that hopefully the Act will begin to work on. I'm not sure ultimately that we're there yet, but I'm hopeful.
So you recently completed work on a master's degree at Dartmouth. And it's in healthcare delivery science, right? And it's a unique program, first of its kind in the nation. And you went with a cohort of other Tulsans. Tell us really what's involved. What is healthcare delivery science, first of all? What are the kinds of things you learn, and where do you hope to take that knowledge?
Well, again, it begins with the question of, you know, what's our goal? And our goal is the best care we can get for a patient. And too often, the way people are paid, primarily hospitals and doctors, they don't really get compensated for delivering quality care. They get compensated for doing things, whether it's a good outcome or a bad outcome. So a lot of the course was focusing on, you know, how do we organize a system along the best interest of the patient? And it's kind of unfortunate that we haven't figured out how to pay for it, so that question isn't one that you have to ask and think about. And I'd say that, you know, a major thing was thinking about systems of care, some providing better quality, some providing maybe lower quality to patient populations in various parts of the country. And you wonder if this is scalable from one region to another. You wonder, given the tremendous fixed costs that hospital systems have, how they're going to withstand maybe a better model that is less reliant on, for example, hospital care and more reliant on care that's delivered outside that system. If you have a more efficient model, but it's a threat to traditional hospital revenue streams, what does that mean? And how do those systems absorb those transitions?
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today is Senator Tom Adelson, who recently completed a master's degree in healthcare delivery science at Dartmouth. Who else was in your cohort at Dartmouth? How many people? Where were they from? What kinds of disciplines were they coming from?
There are, I think, about a little under 50 students in this inaugural program, and they were mostly physicians, probably about 42 or so physicians in wide range, just two physicians who own their own facilities. So we probably could have used a little better perspective for that, but a lot from academic institutions. We were three or four payers, like United Health, an independent plan design person from Pennsylvania. And they're from, you know, California, India, China. They're from everywhere. So you had an international representation, and you had representation across the country.
Wow. So Dartmouth, this new program appealed to individuals from China or India as well. I mean, so countries with huge populations, ostensibly providing universal health care, although I've actually been to China and seen what goes on there. India, I can't speak for, but I do understand there's large gaps in coverage, but a very broad educational system that tries to provide a lot in terms of medical education. What kinds of things do you think the international visitors were trying to take home?
You know, that's a good question. I think that the physician from India was an eye surgeon, and he really leaned heavily on the business school on flow management. They had a big problem with diabetes and blindness and doing lots of eye surgeries there, and he wanted to get as much capacity out of existing resources from his system. So he actually worked with some of the operations management folks at Dartmouth to, and that was his final project, to show how he changed the patient experience without any sacrifice to quality to get more patients through in less time and better results. An interesting question was, you know, what was that international representation, what impact did that have on us? And one of the interesting things, I guess, to think about was a lot of people build, you know, passable health systems that does not rely much on doctors. And it's, I guess, a little bit controversial, but I was amazed at the amount of care and the amount of impact on population health that one can have without really having access to a doctor. And so it was really educational to learn about developing countries and how they handle the challenges they have, given the scarcity of resources that they have.
Yeah, so, you know, if you read, I think, the conventional wisdom at this point, whether it's academic articles or even in the lay press, I've seen it in The Atlantic or Time magazine, definitely predictions with the Affordable Care Act that we will face a shortage, certainly of primary care doctors in the very near future. Estimates by the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education that I'm a part of tens of thousands, 20, 30, 40,000 doctors fewer than needed nationwide in order to meet the new demand for healthcare. And, you know, your perspective in this educational model showed you that there are many other models from around the world that don't rely solely on doctors. So, A, do you believe that there's going to be a shortage, or do you think we have enough physicians? And then B, what if we don't have enough, what can we do?
The short answer is I don't know. I'm skeptical that we have a shortage. There are different ways, there are different technologies that I think are going to democratize the practice of healthcare. I'm using that word, I think, kind of loosely. But, you know, an example is, you know, people are going to be able to diagnose at home in the next 5 or 10 years whether they have strep throat. That's, you know, 100 million visits a year to the doctor. And there's a company that's trying to get FDA approval for their home diagnosis equipment now that you take the test, you submit the results online through your phone, they punch it through to a clinic. If you've got a strep throat, then they take care of your prescription online for you, all for $35. So the promise of technology, which healthcare has been very slow to adopt, really has some labor-saving advantages that I think are a threat to physicians and hospitals. We do have fewer hospital beds today than we did 35, 40 years ago, as we've realized that we can deliver a lot of care outside the hospital setting. And, of course, in Europe, they've vastly reduced their acute care beds with no impact, you know, on patient quality as they've figured out how to better deliver care in the hospital. And this is, of course, you know, Europe and the United States have an aging population, increasing population, but they're able to look at those resources and find new technologies and new innovations that probably change a little bit the labor need. And I just don't know that we have a great understanding of what that will look like.
So you mentioned going back to the private sector and being happy about that. I think many of your constituents are sad. I'm one of them. But now that you're going to be in the private sector and have this added skill and knowledge, where do you see yourself taking the master's degree, for example, or, you know, your law degree or your expertise in healthcare or Oklahoma health policy? What do you think you'll be doing in the next, you know, in the near future?
Well, my core value is, what's the best interest of the patient, and how do you align that patient interest with the provider? Unfortunately, you know, today we don't have, I think, the culture or the knowledge to allow that patient to self-manage his or her care as well as I hope we can in the future. And until then, you know, I like to sit down with providers who are asking to take more financial risk for their patient population, and on a consulting basis, you know, help them think about how they can restructure the delivery of the care with a different way to get paid. So Medicare, for example, and other private payers are starting to push value-based purchase contracts or purchase agreements with the doctors and hospitals. And you know, I'm interested in working with smaller hospitals and health centers and physician practices when they begin that structural challenge to realign their practice along the new payment models.
So in essence, then, using your new talents in the consulting realm to try to help smaller hospitals operationalize some of the tenets, if you will, of the Affordable Care Act, that is accountable care. And we use some jargon. So value-based purchasing, I want to point out, is really what is the, I guess, euphemism for how Medicare is now trying to pay based on quality measurements as opposed to just volume of service delivered. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good way to describe it. I'm starting to think about it more in terms of they're transferring the financial risk to the provider, either the hospital or the physician practice, to the extent physician practices can survive as independent entities. I hope they can. But they're turning these providers into insurance companies in a way. They're going to come in and they're going to pay you, John, a capitated rate with shared savings at the back end if you spend less for that allotted amount for your patient, assuming you meet all these quality metrics as well. And it puts a lot of pressure on the provider to think differently about how they can deliver care, because they're no longer going to be paid based on the volume. They're going to be paid just for that population and that population's experience, their patient population experience with the health system.
So how is accountable care, which is what you described, any different than the managed care that came around in the Clinton years during the 90s that people seem to have quite a backlash against? Is it really just the wolf in sheep's clothing, or is there something that's fundamentally different about accountable care? I mean, did Dartmouth give you any information on that?
Yeah, managed care really, it was the payer that was at financial risk, and now it's the provider that's at financial risk. So I almost think you could think of an ACO as managed care for the provider. To me, that's the essential difference. There might be other nuances that I'm missing, but I think it's a fair comparison that you just analogized to the managed care of the 1990s.
You talked about independent providers, so essentially private practice doctors, and you said if they will continue to exist. And I guess I wanted to unpack that a little. My sense from my reading is that it's harder and harder to stay in business as a private practitioner, and that many more young physicians, the people I train, for example, are coming out of residency and going into salaried positions as employed physicians rather than opening their own practices because of the high cost of overhead and malpractice insurance and whatnot. Do you think that under affordable care that the private physician is going to be squeezed out essentially?
Yeah, that's happening probably independent of the Affordable Care Act, but I think the Affordable Care Act is expediting that. And that's one of the impacts of reform that I'm not in favor of. I think it's unfortunate, primarily because I come from my dad's a pediatrician, my brother's a doc, and I hate to see them being commoditized by these hospitals that are gobbling them up. But I also think that there's a quality issue that is left unaddressed, which is if the system, because you're now being paid for an episode of care, you want to buy everyone downstream and upstream in the continuum of that disease, that system might miss a superior provider who's independent, who is doing a better job caring for his or her patient population. And that person should be rewarded with, market share and more business and not less. And so I'm worried that one of the ill effects of the Affordable Care Act is the ability of the independent physician to have an independent practice.
At Dartmouth, you also were given exposure to something, the Dartmouth Institute, really, that develops this atlas of healthcare. And I was wondering if you could share with our listeners details about the Dartmouth Atlas, essentially that there's this wide variability. You and I were talking before the interview about how you can be in one part of the country and the amount of care or the type of care you get can be vastly different from another part, and even inside Oklahoma, for example.
Yeah, I pulled the Oklahoma data from the Dartmouth program just on my own, just to see, it was kind of interesting to see what it would look like. But the history of the Dartmouth Atlas tracks back to a guy named Jack Wenberg, who 30, 40 years ago noticed that the rate of tonsillectomy was much higher in one Vermont school district than another. I mean, you were five times as likely to get your tonsils out if you went to school A versus school B, and there was no difference in the patient population. And he tracked that to just different pattern of practice between one community doc versus another community physician, I should say. He later got access to Medicare claims data, and over a 30-year period with many other colleagues assembled lots and lots of data by hospital referral region to look at the amount of money Medicare spends, say, in Minneapolis versus Miami. And he noticed that, at least his thesis is that eliminating you know, all of the variables and all of the confounding variables that might, you know, have an impact on his observation, the amount of health care that a Medicare recipient consumes is much more tightly related to the supply of physicians and hospitals rather than actual need. And some of his influence has made it into the Affordable Care Act, mainly in the amount of information that should go to the patient before they decide whether to have a procedure or not, with his belief being that, you know, it should be your need, it should be your demand, and not the fact that a community is invested heavily in hospitals and doctors that are determining overall utilization.
What do you think is the biggest public health challenge facing Tulsans or Oklahomans at the moment? I mean, it seems like we're having a pretty virulent flu season. This may not be a fair question to ask you, but what priorities? I guess if you were in the mayor's office or the governor's chair, what kinds of things would you be investing in now as we go forward in 2013?
Well, I mean, I like and respect Governor Fallon, but I really hope she will look again, you know, with her staff at this Medicaid decision. I think it's a very, very bad financial decision for the state. And just so listeners understand, we don't have all the data today, but if we do nothing, the Affordable Care Act might take as much as $200 million away in federal money. That includes Medicare and Medicaid dollars that are going to be cut, as well as the intra-Oklahoma dollars, which I don't think that we're going to be able to continue that program. I hope I'm wrong. So if you do nothing, you're going to lose that money. If you don't take the Medicaid expansion, then you've just compounded the problem for hospitals and doctors, and that spills over to patients. So I'm worried about access to care, rationed care, lower health outcomes because we've hurt our hospitals and physicians so bad by turning our back on this expansion. Since there's, as I understand it, nothing that we can do about the existing cuts that the Affordable Care Act is going to enact on our public programs today, that's Medicaid, Medicare again, and the Intra-Oklahoma program. The mayor, we have a lot of initiatives, but not a whole lot of resources, I think, to impact the health trajectory of Tulsans. And a lot of our population health challenges, as you know, are lifestyle and how you live and whether you smoke and what your diet and how active you are. And I'm still looking for an effective intervention anywhere in the country, in the globe, that is got something they can brag about. You know, there's a book that I just read, I think called Blue Zones, that looks at four or five parts of the world where people are living in their hundreds. And these are outlier communities where an unusual percent of the population lives, you know, longer and longer. Like Okinawa, Japan is one, and it's a part in California is another. And your ability to see a doc is not really related to how long you live. So people need to bear in mind that 85 to 90% of your overall health status is unrelated to your access to the health system. It really is within your power, although genetics are a big factor as well. And we probably could do a lot better job getting that information out and trying to help people, you know, to live, you know, the best lifestyle they can. It's just very hard to do.
I wanted to ask about some of your former colleagues. I read where in the Oklahoma legislature, a couple of legislators are trying to literally outlaw accommodating the Affordable Care Act. We're on the other side of the aisle. Some legislators are pushing to try to essentially legally force the state to adopt the Medicaid expansion. Do you have any thoughts on these bills going forward, or is this all just sort of jockeying for leverage and position for the upcoming term?
Well, I think you asked early on if I missed the legislature. It's the zaniness that you just mentioned with regard to, I think, criminalizing I don't know if it's doctors or hospitals or patients for complying with the federal laws.
It's actually the laws that's written, I think, is bureaucrats. It's tax officials and people who would be collecting revenue.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I think that's just for effect. But you know, there's a fair amount of that zaniness every session. Senator Burge has got the Medicaid expansion. He's a good friend of mine. I'm a huge fan of Senator Burge. He's very talented and skilled. Lawyer and legislator. And I don't know, I haven't visited with him, I don't know how hard he's going to push that, if it's wise to push it right away, because there are some concerns about running a bill that fails, if that limits our choices going forward. But I do think he thinks that, and rightly so, that we really need to be having a good, fair, and open discussion about what it means to reject the expansion dollars.
What's your cost estimate of, you mentioned the $200 million that Oklahoma would essentially be turning away in Medicare, Medicaid dollars. One of Governor Fallon's arguments for not accepting the Medicaid money is that the 10% that the state would have to contribute after 3 years, or I guess by the year 2020, would be, you know, an astronomical sum. I mean, do you find her numbers credible?
Yeah, I mean, again, the full explanation needs to be, we're losing this Medicaid disproportionate share dollar. That's $45 million a year. We're losing Medicaid, not Medicare. So Medicaid dish, $45 million a year. We're using Medicare, and that amount is still being calculated, but it might be in the $100 million a year or more. I'm still not quite sure that figure is. And then we're losing, again, I think we are in danger of losing the intra-Oklahoma dollars. That's $100 million a year. And that's regardless of any decision that's made at the state level. So then the question is, can we draw down other federal revenue to make up that gap? And leveraging a 9-to-1 return by the 10% that she doesn't want to spend to draw down the 90% of federal dollars, that's just, you know, I don't want to say negligent, but I can't think of a better word. If that was your financial manager, you know, you'd have questions to ask. That's just not a good dollars and cents decision. You could easily, for example, the tobacco tax money that is currently in effect that supports intra-Oklahoma, the state tobacco tax, that's about $40 million a year. What are we going to do with that? We could use that to draw down the federal share, and you'd almost be made whole. So it's not near the cost that we're hearing from some folks in the governor's office and elsewhere on what the costs are to the state. I don't buy those figures, but I'm still trying to get better data myself.
So having been on the inside, I'd ask on behalf of our listeners, what are some things we could do to try to move this ball forward in terms of at least getting the leadership to recognize this opportunity? Just letter writing or?
Yeah, I mean, the chamber is doing a pretty good job, the Tulsa chamber, I think. I'm not sure about the state chamber, but I know that they've made it a priority. I think that, you know, there will probably receive some, you know, behind the scenes pressure from others not to be overly aggressive. That would be a mistake. Jake Henry is the St. Francis CEO, is heading the chamber. He knows the numbers better than anybody. And I really hope that they're aggressive and that we rely on our business leaders as well as our citizens to, you know, put the pressure on, publicize this information. Let's look at a complete, you know, income and expense statement from all sources, federal and state, to figure out what the dollars are coming in, what they're going out, and what it might mean for hospitals. I don't know of another alternative. I mean, if there is one, that would be great. But I don't know of another alternative that would be close to the one that we're currently saying no to, or the governor is currently saying no to.
So again, it sort of mirrors really what you're saying about making healthcare decisions, essentially having as a complete a set of information as you can, because it seems like we're getting different sets of one-sided information, essentially.
Yeah, get all the information. If, you know, you're a physician, other physicians hopefully are putting pressure on the OSMA. Hospitals are putting pressure on the Oklahoma Hospital Association. And, you know, citizens who may or may not know what this means, hopefully they're able to call their local legislator and say, "What, you know, why are you saying no to this money? Explain to me financially why this makes sense."
Senator Tom Adelson, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks a lot for having me. It's great to be here.
Senator Tom Adelson served the 33rd District in the Oklahoma Legislature from 2004 to 2012. Well, that's On Health for today. Studio Tulsa On Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed on this program are those of our guests and commentators and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you missed part of today's conversation or any of our programs, you can stream audio and hear archive shows at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.